Welcome back on this last day of June. We have been talking quite a bit about police activities and shootings, and we were talking about the Highland Park shooter who was in court this past week, and 604 mass shootings last year. 754 were killed, 2,400 wounded. It's almost like we've become numb and immune to some of these daily shootings. I want to talk a little bit more about what is causing this. Is it mental health issues? Is it the guns? We have more guns than any other country, but is this the cause? And who are the victims, and how are they being targeted? And finally, you know, what can we do to stop this, what amounts to a public health crisis? With us to discuss the issue is one of the country's foremost experts on mass shootings, Dr. Adam Lankford. He's the chair and professor at University of Alabama Criminology and Criminal Justice Department. He researches, teaches, writes, and speaks on the issue. He's the author of Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers and Killing Machines. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lankford. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about your study of mass shootings. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you went about studying it and what the breadth of your research entailed?
Sure. Well, the first question was pretty simple. Where do public mass shooters attack? How often? And how does the United States compare to other countries? And so, you know, essentially I just looked at more than a 40-year period and identified every case I could find of a public mass shooting, you know, not only in the United States, not only in English-speaking countries, but all the places around the world. And essentially what the results show was that the United States by far had the most public mass shooters. We had roughly 30% of all perpetrators of this type. And if you think about the fact that we have less than 5% of the world's population, that means we really had, you know, about six times more public mass shooters than we should have if they were distributed, you know, kind of equally. And then, of course, the next question is like, well, why? And, you know, the United States overall, good news, is not the most dangerous country in the world in terms of overall homicide risk or war or armed conflict or terrorism. We don't have the highest suicide rate, which is often associated with mental health problems, but we do have the most firearms by a long shot. You know, we have more than 200 million more firearms than any other country, and our firearm per civilian rate dwarfs everywhere else in the world. And unfortunately, when you look at the statistics, the statistical relationship appears to be between firearms or firearm access and the number of public mass shootings a country has.
So let's talk a little bit about the type of person who does a mass shooting. And do you have to delineate between young people who do these school shootings versus mass shootings, say, in the workplace or at venues and events? Or do you kind of put everyone together when you study these issues?
Well, it's a great question. So, you know, when I'm looking at kind of the worst of the worst, you know, things like Highland Park, Columbine, Uvalde, Las Vegas, Sandy Hook, Virginia Tech, you know, these attacks at schools, workplaces, malls, churches, other public places, typically scholars look at those incidents that resulted in at least four more victims being killed. It's somewhat of an arbitrary threshold, but it ensures that we are looking at perpetrators who really had clear, substantial homicidal intent, and not these other individuals who sometimes attack at schools in particular and are kind of interested in committing an attack, but they're less homicidal and ultimately less murderous. So, you know, I guess this is my way of saying when you look at the worst of the worst, typically they're all grouped together regardless of location type, regardless of differences in their motives, because, you know, essentially there's a sample size issue. When you want to look for trends, it helps to have a big sample size. And if you start breaking down these perpetrators into smaller little categories, it becomes harder to identify patterns. But, you know, some of my research does that too, because really if they're important differences, and we may discuss some of them today, they do need to be recognized.
So what are the traits that you see? Obviously, there are outliers, but what are the traits of someone who's capable of doing a mass shooting? And what are the red flags that you are going to see, let's say, in the 1 year preceding the event?
Sure. You know, there are a lot of different things that stand out, but one of the things I would emphasize is, you know, these are acts of mass murder, but in many cases, it's more helpful to think about them as mass murder suicide. Now, of course, sometimes individuals like the Highland Park shooter don't end up dying by suicide, but we know that that individual had made suicidal threats and expressed suicidal ideation in the past. And, you know, if you just look at crime in general in the United States, you know, if you look at bank robbery, for example, bank robbery is nowhere near as self-destructive. Plenty of people commit bank robbery, you know, not that I'm encouraging it, and get away with it. But when it comes to public mass shootings, this is a crime that almost always end in life imprisonment, the death penalty, or the perpetrator's death at the scene. So that self-destructive element is tremendously important. And then, you know, kind of as we talk about suicide, your listeners have probably heard that sometimes it's discussed that, you know, people who are interested in suicide sometimes reveal that information. They make a cry for help. They tip what they're going to do in advance. And we often see the same thing in terms of a red flag with public mass shootings that, believe it or not, it's not rational, but they actually tell people that they're interested in committing this type of attack in advance. And that's the most clear warning sign. You know, if someone's talking about their interest in this kind of thing, believe them, because often, you know, those words are not just kind of false brags or boasts, and they end up going through with those actions.
Let's take a break. We're talking to Dr. Adam Lankford. He is the chair and professor at the University of Alabama Criminology and Criminal Justice Department. You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. We're talking to Dr. Adam Lankford. He is an expert in mass shootings. He's done a lot of research and talking and writing about these very issues. So are these people who, and it's, I guess maybe some of this is semantics, doctor, are these people who are mentally ill? Do they have personality disorders, or do they just have some semblance of disordered thinking? Dr.
The challenges
Go ahead. Could you start again? I'm sorry.
Sure. Great question. One of the challenges here is that they don't all have the same kind of psychiatric diagnosis. And we do have some individuals who are severely mentally ill in terms of, you know, they have delusions and hallucinations and they're hearing voices and they're literally out of touch with reality. But we have other people who are, you know, the Highland Park shooter told police that he was depressed. He was depressed and suicidal. And sometimes that creates a greater challenge because, you know, he might be able to sound convincing, right? He may be able to make a rational argument. He may be able to give a sentence that doesn't scream that this person has serious problems. But, you know, ultimately, if someone's willing to commit mass murder and then willing to risk their lives and potentially sacrifice their lives in this kind of attack, you know, there's clearly something profoundly problematic and unhealthy in terms of their mental state.
When you hear these shooters who have like a manifesto, or they're targeting African Americans in a grocery store, or you could just see that they're focusing their hatred on a group of people. How does that happen? I mean, where does that start, and why does it focus the way it does? I mean, it just seems like a strange way to vent your anger, you know?
Well, absolutely. And one of the kind of fascinating things is, you know, I've been looking at this subset of so-called ideological mass shooters, and often they haven't personally experienced, you know, any suffering at the segment of society they blame, whether it's a racial group, whether it's a religious group. Essentially, you know, in many of these cases, we have perpetrators who've been self-radicalized online. So they've, you know, their own problems are probably being lonely and unhealthy and having no purpose in life. They spend a ton of time on the internet, and then they find an ideology or a kind of hateful mindset online that basically tells them, oh, all your problems are not your own failures. All your problems are the fault of some other group. And then in the manifestos themselves, you know, they're probably in many cases, trying to make themselves seem smarter, more important, part of a broader cause, instead of really just kind of a lone and disconnected individual who hasn't been able to achieve anything meaningful in his life.
Interesting. So you don't think that most of these people have been targeted by a specific group to do these things. It's just that they're sort of latching on to some hatred that sort of resonates with them.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, that's one of the things that law enforcement or the FBI would carefully study. You know, has this person been deployed by a group? And if they were, then we would go and try to tackle that group and, you know, make sure this couldn't happen again. You know, one of the challenges is that when it comes to self-radicalization, you know, there's 320 million people in this country. And, you know, most of them have access to the internet, and some of them are at risk due to significant personal problems. And so because you can't just trace, you know, who have you been connected to? What meetings have you been going to? You know, are you a member of an extremist group? If you're not a member, it makes it harder to track your behavior and prevent these from a law enforcement perspective.
Why don't you see female mass shooters?
Well, it's a great question. You know, one of the things we can do statistically is look at traits of when women engage in, you know, homicidal or suicidal behavior. In general, women commit less homicide, less suicide, less murder for things like status, you know, which is sometimes seen in also in like gang killings and stuff like that, and less murder of strangers. When you look at weapons, women are less likely to use firearms, and the gap between men and women is closer when it comes to something like using poison or using arson. So, you know, essentially public mass shootings where you're killing strangers or random bystanders, it just doesn't check many of the types of boxes of the types of violence that women do engage in when they want to kill.
Is there something to be said for the idea that at least some mass shooters want to be famous, and that this is their way to make a name for themselves? And is this something unique to the United States? Because I always think of our country as being kind of a country where people want to be famous for being famous, the Kim Kardashians of the world and those types of things, and that we're a little bit heavier when it comes to people who want to do things to be famous. And does this play into the mass shooters' desires?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when it comes to like comparing the United States to other countries, it can be difficult to quantify that. But absolutely, there are, you know, public polls of Americans that show things like, you know, 50% of millennials say they want to be famous. And not only that, but like roughly 50% say their life should be made into a movie. You know, it's kind of a reality TV effect gone wild.
Wow.
And the reason that's a problem is because then you have these people who have no special talents. They're desperate. They don't have anything to live for. And the only way they can guarantee themselves fame is by killing. You know, some of the studies I've done showed that, you know, in one study I found that the average mass killer got something like $10 million worth of free advertising from the media.
Oh, you
know,
my
like
goodness.
Super Bowl level advertising from the media. So it's rewarding and incentivizing people who want attention or want attention after their death, kind of a legacy. It's incentivizing them to kill more victims because many of these shooters have explicitly said, which is kind of something that's common sense, which is the more victims that they kill, the more attention and fame they get. And then it also fuels these kind of contagion and copycat effects where, you know, you have one high profile mass shooter who got rewarded, and then you have someone else sitting at home seeing that on TV and deciding they want to do the same thing.
And this is all speculation, Doctor, but this week we saw the Highland Park shooter. And by the way, I'm not saying his name. I'm just not going to for that very reason. He came into court. He was in a wheelchair. He was supposed to change his plea, and he didn't, much to the dismay of many of the families and the victims' families who were there. Is this something that would be consistent with the idea that he wants the attention and the control and the spotlight?
It certainly could be, absolutely. You know, and there were things. So we have some mass shooters who explicitly said, I want to be famous. You know, they left behind documents that clarified that without any doubt. But we also have people like the Highland Park shooter who, you know, there's allegations that maybe he like tried to make his own Wikipedia page, that he was trying to become a famous rapper, you know, that he was trying to become famous in other ways prior to his attack. And then if we think about people like, for example, you know, Ted Bundy, who defended himself in court, you know, that certainly is a way that some individuals, especially, you know, when they're facing life in prison, they kind of imagine this last hurrah of being the center of attention in court, and that would be satisfying in a way that pleading guilty might not be.
Is there a correlation between mass shootings and domestic violence? And I ask this because as we were waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to make a decision as to whether or not it violates a person's Second Amendment rights to deprive them of their handguns or their firearms if they've been accused and actually convicted of domestic violence, whether that was constitutional. I was looking at some of the statistics, and it seems like there is a correlation.
Yeah, well, you know, so there's, I guess, a couple different things going on here. One is the most common type of mass murder, when we just talk about mass murder in general, that's family killings. So, and most commonly it would be, you know, a man with a history of domestic violence killing his wife and other children or relatives in the home. So, you know, that's the most common type of mass murder in general. I've actually recently been looking at this specific issue when it comes to public mass shooters, and one of the things we found is that roughly one quarter of public mass shooters specifically targeted at least one woman as someone they wanted to kill during their attack. So maybe they wanted to kill people at random, but they also had a specific woman they wanted to kill. And in some of these cases, like Sandy Hook, where the perpetrator first killed his mother in the home and then went to the school and committed the school shooting, or the Uvalde case where the perpetrator shot his grandmother, who fortunately survived somehow, and then went to the school. You know, even back in 1966, there's the University of Texas tower shooter who murdered his wife and his mother before committing a mass shooting more broadly. So there absolutely is a connection there. You know, it has various nuances, but I think there's a lot of researchers who would say, look, if this person had a history of domestic violence and shouldn't have a firearm for that reason, it would have not only made things safer for the family, but also for the public at large.
If you can stay with us for a little bit, Dr. Langford, I would like to discuss a little bit about some of the ways that you can, you know, some of the red flags, let's say, and on the issue of red flags, these red flag laws, how important are they going to be moving forward to preventing these kinds of things? And then we're going to bring back my prior guest, Dan Murphy, who is a retired New York police detective sergeant who has worked in the issues of terrorism and has worked on the streets of New York. And I'm sure he's going to have some questions and comments for us. But stay tuned. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We are talking about mass shootings, and we're here with two guests today. We have Dr. Adam Langford. He is a chair and professor at University of Alabama, and he teaches and writes on the issue of mass shootings. And he is the author of Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. And we're also here with Dan Murphy, who is a retired New York police detective sergeant. And thank you both of you for joining me. Let's talk a little bit about, you know what, Dan, you had a question during break, and you had a question for Dr. Langford. You want to ask that?
Certainly. Dr. Langford, it's a pleasure to speak to you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have, I've done some research myself on the topic of active shooter, and during my corporate roles, I was the chief security officer for U.S. Bank, and I was responsible for protecting a lot of people, and I really wanted to learn a little bit more about some of the drivers behind the mass shootings that we've been seeing a serious societal uptick in America in this area. And one of the things that I saw, and I'm curious for your take on it, has to do with the overall desensitization to violence that as a society we're seeing. Younger kids are seeing much more realistic violence, whether it be in video games, movies, television, and is that impacting them? And the second thing that I saw as a driver that was suggested, and maybe it's even been proven, was the presence of fetal alcohol syndrome in some of these mass shooters. I'm curious for your experience in those areas.
Yeah, those are good questions. I got to say, I really don't know about the fetal alcohol syndrome. I do know that, you know, in a small study of perpetrators where I looked at them in great depth, you know, there certainly were some where even by age three, you know, the parents knew something was wrong, right? Something was wrong kind of in terms of mental health problems or in terms of the behavior of this child. In other words, this was not a case where it was like, oh, so-and-so was normal, and then all of a sudden, you know, at age 23, no one could have expected this. You know, and when we see the Highland Park shooter or we look at a Parkland school shooter, the Aurora shooter, you know, there are various cases where it's like there were so many problems throughout the lifespan that it suggests like this was something organic, right? Something, not that the kid was predestined to become a mass shooter because you can go a different direction, but there was just something profoundly wrong with this individual that ultimately wasn't treated in an effective way. When it comes to desensitization, you know, it's a fascinating subject. So, you know, on the one hand, desensitization as a psychological concept absolutely is tremendously meaningful. You know that even for, you know, law enforcement and the military, you know, training involves desensitization, right? That, that's how, when you need to use violence for legitimate purposes, you become more comfortable doing so. On the other hand, you know, even with things like video games or movies, you know, there can be a gap between the individual's comfort level while engaged in some sort of virtual behavior at home and their comfort in doing something like this in the real world. You know, and then kind of further adding to this, you know, I actually have a study that's in progress right now looking at this concept of gamification. And part of it is this idea that some of these perpetrators, they are online gamers, and then they talk about gaming in a way that that makes it equivalent with killing. So they talk about, you know, instead of killing individual people as a horrible thing, it's like, well, people you kill are part of your high score, you know, that... what you do during your mass killing is a set of goals or achievements. You can get bonuses, you know, so they're almost taking a game-like perspective on it and applying it to mass shooting. So, you know, now, of course, there's many millions of people who play video games and watch violent movies who don't do these things, but I do think, you know, you could make an interesting argument that it can be an exacerbating factor for individuals who are already at risk.
Well, and, you know, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of fantasy that goes on with killings like this, and fantasies when it goes on with killings for, you know, serial killers. They spend years fantasizing about doing things, and finally they start doing it. And I would imagine that the video games could enhance it and, you know, and further it. And if you take an interest in that kind of stuff, maybe you had it to begin with. So it's kind of chicken and the egg, I guess, right?
Absolutely. And just to add to that, you know, first of all, some of these people realize after they start shooting that the fantasy wasn't all it was cracked up to be, you know, so you sometimes see people and it's like, oh, they're planning on killing 50 people and they shot a couple people and then they stopped because it was horrible, right? The experience was not fun. The fantasy was fun. The experience was terrible. The other thing I'd say is like sometimes the you know, fitting with our conversation earlier about fame seeking and attention seeking and some of these people being kind of so lonely, you know, sometimes their only friends are other gamers online. And so that for people who lack perspective, especially young men with other deeper problems, sometimes they think like, oh, I'm going to do this thing and my online friends will be impressed by it and they'll respect me more, you know, when that is its own kind of delusion.
We have a Oak Parker, who said, I'm a licensed counselor of 35 years in community mental health. I've grown to believe that apart from acute thought disorder diagnosis, such criminals possess a prevalence of a personality disorder from lack of positive early attachment, which creates a distorted filter in their mind. And those are kind of technical terms, but it sounds about right. Let's go back, Dr. Langford, to the idea of, let's take school shooters, so the younger people who are in high school, who are are doing these kinds of things. What are the bullet points, pardon the pun, of the type of kids who are doing this? I mean, they're loners. They have friends. They don't have friends. What is their home life like? Give us an idea of the background and the CV of a kid who's going to do this kind of thing.
Sure. Well, I guess there are a couple things to call attention to. I've found, and the researchers I respect have said the same thing, which is essentially that social marginalization is even a more useful concept than isolation. So you may have people who are not literally alone, but they feel like they don't belong. And so that absolutely is common among these younger school shooters. You also see that many are especially susceptible to role model influence and this kind of fame seeking that we've talked about, where it's if only I was famous, it would fix everything in my life, right? I would have a girlfriend. I would have respect. I would have friends. I would have money. Part of this fantasy is that that they could solve all their problems in one fell swoop. And when they kind of give up on that, they may say, well, okay, I couldn't get it in life, but at least I'll be important in death. Of course, we see some other things as well. We see more firearms being illegally obtained for younger school shooters. We also, on the more fortunate side, we do see more failed cases or thwarted cases. So cases where someone thought that a school shooting was a good idea, but was talking about it and got reported and actually was stopped and treated or helped. Or where they showed up to the school with a gun even, and then they were talked down or stopped or tackled. And so, in some of these cases, fortunately, the young people who develop these unhealthy fascinations are not beyond saving.
And you talked a little bit earlier, Doctor, about how some of these, particularly the young shooters, and I think maybe you're talking about all of them, would say things to people, would say, hey, I really feel like shooting this place up, I'm going to do this, or I'm thinking about doing this. At what point do you take someone seriously? Because you hear this over and over again. He told me that, but I thought he was goofing around. He always talked big. He always talked in a grandiose fashion. I had no idea he was actually going to take the action and do it. When do you take someone seriously?
I think the answer is always. If we develop a culture with zero tolerance for these kind of comments, then people will stop saying them as jokes. And if all the jokes evaporate, if they disappear, then all that's left is the serious ones. But I would overreact rather than underreact. One of the things that's been kind of challenging is some people like to rationalize, and they're like, well, if somebody was really going to do it, they wouldn't say it because then they could be stopped, as if this person is, a covert operative working for special forces or something. When in reality, part of what we've been talking about with fantasy and desensitization is sometimes people like to talk about something almost as a way of building up their nerve before they do it, and if they're just seeking attention, attention seeking and fame seeking is itself a risk factor and a warning sign. So, there have even been cases the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooter back in 2016. He was talking about doing something like this, committing a mass shooting, engaging in terrorism, something like that. And the FBI went and interviewed him and determined that it seemed like he was bragging, exaggerating, lying. He claimed to be related to Osama bin Laden and things like that, things that weren't true. But I guess in retrospect, it turned out that that bragging, that desire for attention, those boasts were a warning sign. They were not something to be dismissed.
Let's take a break. And I want to talk a little bit with Dan Murphy about, you have some ideas about how to deal with some of the mass shootings and some strategical types of activities. And then I want to, again, talk about red flag laws and how do we find the way to turn this around and to stop this trend from going up, up, up. Is it the guns? Is it the mental health issues? What is it? We're talking with Dr. Adam Langford and Dan Murphy, who's in studio, and you're listening to WGN. We're talking about mass shootings. This is a fascinating conversation. We have two really special guests, Dan Murphy, who is a retired detective sergeant from the New York Police Department. He's also had some experience with terrorism and different things that involve these issues. And then Dr. Adam Lankford, who is the author of The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Welcome back, and thank you for hanging with me this afternoon. First of all, I wanted to ask Dan Murphy, you were talking to me, we were talking about the Highland Park shooting, and you told me you had some ideas about how these kinds of things should be handled from a tactical standpoint.
Yeah, you know, in my corporate roles, I was responsible for the safety and security of people in numerous buildings around the world. And one of the things I noticed during my planning and helping even as a consultant was that when it came to active shooters, there's been a lot of money spent and a lot of thought power that has gone into coming up with where we currently are as law enforcement, corporate security, and even as a risk management approach towards these shooters and these events in buildings. And we utilize cameras and access control, and we have police response, and we have all this other stuff. And I actually have watched as all this has developed, and I can't help but think that there's a gap, because the gap is obvious. Doing a simple gap analysis will tell you this. Someone walks into a building looking to hurt somebody, and let's be honest, if you look at the history, it doesn't matter what sort of access control system you have, doesn't matter whether you have guards. If someone wants to get into a building, history has shown they will get in. And if they want to commit a mass shooting, they will be able to do it, period. So let's accept that. So what happens then is we tell people to run, hide, or fight, which is okay. You have to train people to do something. Run if you can, hide if you can't, fight if you must. But we're putting them in a position where they're waiting for a police response, because until then, the shooter owns control of the building. So we're waiting for the police response, which can be anywhere from 2 minutes to 20 minutes or a half an hour, depending upon where you are. And when that happens, you are letting people die. And then I look at, there's two main threats to people in buildings, fire and human. Two main threats to life. Over 100 years ago, somebody very smart figured out a way to protect people in buildings against fire. It's called a fire suppression system, and we're sitting under one right now. Just about every commercial building in America, by code, has to have one. And that's because when a fire hits a building, you can't wait for the fire department. You have to do something to immediately begin to confront and suppress the fire. Yet we haven't adopted this against people. We still, hopefully, we can lock ourselves in. Hopefully the cops will get there. Hopefully they'll stop shooting. Hope is not a life safety plan. Could you imagine getting on a plane and the pilot said, I've watched videos on this and hopefully we'll arrive safely. It's that serious. We have to do something smarter. If we build the answer into buildings to suppress and confront immediately a fire, why don't we do it against people?
And give us an example of what that might be.
Well, you know, people have tried smoke. Smoke doesn't work for a variety of reasons. But there are elements. I will say, for example, my impact spray could potentially be used if it's engineered properly, which is something I am working on, shameless plug, to see if it could be sprayed into a person that would neutralize them, but not necessarily fatally. Because if you hit innocent people, you don't want them killed. Do we have to wait for the police before something touches that person? I think we put a man on the moon in 1969, if you believe that. It's 2024, and we still tell people in buildings, you're going to wait for the police, and when they get there, everything will be fine. And I think history has shown us that that's not necessarily the case. So I believe in having something that can immediately touch that person in a safe yet effective way and neutralize them so that the shooting stops.
Very interesting. And I imagine the insurance companies would be on board with that because they're going to minimize their risk. And it's a very interesting concept. I guess it's shameful for me to even think that we have to do that in this society.
You know, I had an opportunity a few years ago after I left U.S. Bank. I called a few of my peers who were chief security officers for large companies. And I asked them, what do you consider to be priority number one once somebody enters a building with a weapon looking to harm someone? And I received a lot of answers. One was get 911 called right away. Two was make sure you lock the building down. Three, make sure you make an announcement so everybody knows. And I said, those are all priorities, but none of them is priority number one. Priority number one is stop the shooting as soon as possible.
Makes sense. Dr. Lankford, let's talk a little bit about what your thoughts are on red flag laws. And for those who don't really understand what they are, can you tell our listeners?
Sure. In the simplest version, it's essentially saying, what do we do in cases where there's been evidence that someone poses a significant threat? So there's been red flags or warning signs, except in this particular case, maybe the individual hasn't broken the law yet and should not be held in jail or in prison, and is not so severely mentally ill that they should be institutionalized in a psychiatric hospital. Well, you know, what is not a good solution is to say to law enforcement, well, you kind of have to wait around until this person gets really close to committing a mass shooting and then stop that person. And what we'd like to do from that individual's perspective is say, like, let's give this person the benefit of the doubt. Let's let them have all their rights, all their freedoms, with the exception of that right to possess firearms. So they can continue to walk around society, but they pose less of a danger if they get dangerous impulses. And so essentially law enforcement would be able to seize firearms that were in the possession of that individual. In the version of the law I like the best, also purchase would be, or acquisition of new firearms would be prohibited. And this is all subject to judicial review, so that if the person feels like a red flag law is being applied unfairly, that they could, you know, go to court and get their rights back if any illegitimate, claims have been made.
And, you know, I know there's different varieties and a lot of states don't have red flag laws. To me, this seems like a federal law that should be, but so that everybody knows what it means to report somebody, that they have a right to report somebody, that they're not going to be retaliated against if they do that, which I imagine a lot of people are very concerned about that. And has there, to your knowledge, been a law proposed or people talking about that?
I think it really is something that's been happening on a state-by-state basis. Now, I do know that some states maybe call these laws something different, perhaps for political reasons. But, you know, back when the Parkland school shooting happened, you know, which was February 2018, you know, even an NRA spokesperson came out in support of red flag laws. You know, since that point, unfortunately, it's become more politicized, and so the NRA has walked away from that, and you know, people have been kind of fighting on both sides of this as if it's a political issue, but really it's a public health or a safety issue. You know, ultimately, I guess, you know, the key is just, like, there's some cases here where the person so clearly poses a danger, and we have an option to just reduce the amount of danger they pose, you know, especially in cases where they're explicitly talking about their interest in harming themselves or harming others. You know, the Highland Park shooter said he wanted to kill everyone in his family. You know, he was reported to law enforcement for that reason. But then, kind of to your point about clarity nationwide, you know, you not only need to have the laws, but you need to use them effectively.
Dr. Lankford, thank you so much for joining us here on WGN. Dr. Adam Lankford, he's the author of Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'm going to wrap up with you, Dan. We were talking, you were talking a little bit about your work in terrorism, and you mentioned that people are traveling abroad and they should be very concerned that there's higher levels of alerts for terrorism. Can you tell us a little bit about what people should think about when they're traveling abroad?
I would say travel freely, but travel smartly. If you visit a variety of online sources, you can get all your open source data that can tell you about the place you're going, what to expect. Sometimes it's even as simple as tapping into local newspapers and finding about a crime trending or whether or not there's been societal upheaval. But traveling smart is the simple, single best way to do it. I also tell people whenever asked, if you're going to travel as an American in a post-9/11 world, be very careful with your passport. You look American to begin with. And I, not to sound, you know, flip about this, but I would tell people, tell anyone who asks that you're a Canadian.
Dan Murphy, thank you so much for joining me. And watch, listen to Gold Shields, the great podcast, on wherever you listen to your podcasts. Have a great week, everyone. Happy 4th of July from the Karen Conti Show on WGN.